The Guardian.
Hello, welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly, where today we'll look back at the 1995 Champions League final between Ajax and AC Milan with the Stadio boys, Moussa Okonkwo and Ryan Hunt. And then Archie Rintutt will join us and we'll look back at the Bundesliga returning. Barry, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks, Max. I'm really looking forward to this, our hot take on the return of the Bundesliga, because it's kind of football's best kept secret. I haven't read about it anywhere. There's been very little coverage of the return of the Bundesliga. And I think this could be a Football Weekly scoop. The Bundesliga's back. We have men on the case. Some of our best men, it must be said. But yeah, no one seems to have noticed. I picked up the Observer today. I think there was only three articles about the return of the Bundesliga, a league we normally wouldn't give the time of day. But yeah, it's fun. It's football and it's back.
Question from Gerard here. Hi, folks. Had my coffee this morning in my Football Weekly mug with the picture of the old regime adorning it. Any chance you could speak to the people at Guardian HQ and get a new one with Max and Barry on the front?
Well, I had one of those old regime mugs as well. By old regime, it was AC Jimbo on the front, obviously. I enjoyed his coverage on BT Sport yesterday. His beard is looking magnificent. And he unleashed a pun at the end of the Schalke-Dortmund game. The Schalke keeper, a fella called Schubert, not one of his better games, and Jimbo alluded to a Schubert dip, which worked on three levels. The fact that it was Schubert and a dip, Sherbert dip, and EMF, who we mentioned on the pod only last Thursday, had an album called Schubert Dip, but not one of his pundits, Raphael Honigstein and Owen Hargreaves being the guilty men, and Paul Lambert, not one of them even acknowledged his amazing pun. So Jimbo still got it.
Is this your come and get me plea?
He needs me more than I need him. I think we've proved that.
Well, debatable. Anyway, we've got
you're my wife now.
Plenty to get on with today. And in part two, we'll look back at Ajax 1, AC Milan 0, the Champions League final of 1995.
Hey, it's Leia Green here. I want to tell you about a new podcast we're launching, and we'd like to get you involved. It's called All By Ourselves, and right now we're collecting personal stories about home, relationships, and how our lives changed in 2020.
The curtain goes round the coffin while you listen to some bit of Mozart or whatever it is, and that feels very strange.
He's got this like really weird thing in his head where he thinks like I'm like a witch.
So if you have something to share, big or small, funny or tragic, weird or wonderful, get in touch. Email us on all.by.ourselves@theguardian.com or visit gu.com/ABO.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly, where we're going to talk about the 1995 Champions League final between Ajax and AC Milan, and we're going to bring in the Stadio boys to do it with us, Moussa Okonkwo and Ryan Hunn. Moussa, how are you?
Very good, thanks. How are you keeping?
Yeah, I'm really good, thank you very much. Ryan, how are you?
I'm right, thanks, Max.
Now, look, the last time we had you guys on was the last time that Barry and I were in the Guardian offices. It was the day of Boris Johnson's address announcing lockdown in the UK, and you were already locked down, and since then, are you out of lockdown completely now?
Kind of. I mean, I had my first pizza in 2 months, so my first meal outside the house, sitting outside on a street corner in a restaurant. And it felt like liberation, you know, considering that for the last 2 months, I've been out of the house on average, maybe about half an hour each day maximum. So it's been really liberating the last few days to be stretching my legs and see the streets a bit more full. I mean, you have to go down to the stores and wear masks, of course, and it's quite easy to get hold of masks, and they're compulsory in public transport too, as well as in shops. But generally speaking, the mood is so much lighter. you know, the problem with the lockdown, of course, for those weeks that we were under it, was that there was nothing to look forward to or plan for, which I think is one reason why the football's come back. Angela Merkel, Chancellor Merkel, said a really important factor in easing the lockdown was the mental health of people staying at home, because people have to have something to plan for. So to that extent, you know, football's back. That's, you know, that's really good in its limited form. And we've got a bit more freedom to move around, which is, again, great.
What flavour pizza was it?
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so it had the Bressola and the buffalo mozzarella.
Okay, yeah.
This, oh, my goodness, this thing was exquisite. I was grinning like I was just, everyone that walked past, I was like a Cheshire cat. Everyone that walked past was like, oh, my goodness. It was like that scene in Shawshank Redemption when he's on the rooftop. He's on the rooftop with the beers and the sun. It was like that.
Ryan, have you had a similar moment?
Not really, but before Musa, was it Pomodorino?
No, it wasn't.
Oh, wow.
It wasn't.
Oh, he's cheating.
I know, and I'm not, naming on the podcast, our favorite spot, because it's my new place.
Yeah, incidentally, there's a guy who works in that pizza place that I just mentioned who looks a little bit like Bettis's Joaquin. So if anyone's
right?
Passing, yeah.
That is a deep cut. That's a deep cut.
Bit of Berlin chat for you. Yeah, I think I think for me, I was on a kind of a bit of a stay at home thing anyway, just as lockdown started in Berlin, because I'd had a small minor procedure and we'd gone remote. We'd taken the decision to go remote at that point because I was making frequent trips to the hospital. So it was a bit of the way that my experience of it has been quite gradual, where it's been gradually into lockdown. It wasn't so sudden. And then the first month was very limited to just supermarket and home and the occasional walk. And then I started relaxing that a little bit, meeting a few more friends for socially distant coffees when the weather was good. And so for me, it's been quite fluid, because they weren't as super strict as they were in the UK, I don't think, or definitely not as strict as they were in Spain or Italy. So cafes could still remain open and restaurants could still remain open for takeaway only. And then more shops started open gradually, and now they've expanded that a little bit more. So it's all felt quite fluid, if you like. It hasn't felt so stop-start, if that makes sense.
Can I just ask, is the view from Germany when they look at what's going on in the UK just one of wide-eyed bafflement and disbelief?
I think it's been a recurring theme over the last few years on a number of issues. I think a lot of people just are quite, I wouldn't say confused, but maybe confused is the right word. I don't know really. I find myself being asked a lot, are your family okay? And which is a really strange question if you think about it, because I mean, it's a really nice question in a way. People are checking that your family are okay, but they are so concerned from what they perceive to be the situation in the UK that friends who are German or other friends who live here who don't have family in England are genuinely concerned if everyone's okay. So that gives you a bit of a glimpse into how people are viewing it from here.
You know, to me, I would say it's almost like there's confusion. There's a lot of shock. It was almost like this tidal wave was approaching the beach. And then you got like people just sitting on the beach still like unfolding packs of sandwiches. Like everyone was like, this is what is coming. And people are not doing anything. And this, even the concept of like easing the lockdown, people are like, what are you doing? You tested a few people. Yeah, but you didn't trace. You didn't isolate. Like, how can you ease a lockdown if you're not tracing who's got it? This is like, and I've got a lot of friends who work in the medical sort of world, the healthcare world industry in Germany, and they were talking about it and just shock, actually. And a lot of, yeah, that's the right, a lot of concern.
I would be keen to stress that Germany hasn't been perfect by any measure, and there have been criticisms from people within the health industry here as well, or the health service, I should say. But I think the main difference that I can see, and obviously I get a little bit wary sometimes about commenting on things in the UK being here, because obviously we're not there. So it's a very easy criticism for people just to fire back at us when we do talk about stuff like that. But I think that the one main difference that I've noticed from the coverage, because obviously I watch a lot of the coverage from the UK stuff, is just that the messaging has been really clear. Angela Merkel did a TV address very early on and really coherently explained why these measures were being taken. And for those who don't know, Angela Merkel is East German. And so she conveyed that message of how important freedom of movement is for her, because she hasn't always had that. So it was a really difficult decision to make. And I think people got it. You know, people might not have agreed with it, but they could see that it was a really difficult decision to make. And she really articulately explained how the difference in infection rate just going up 0.1 can overwhelm the health service. So people understood, which I think in the UK, the messaging is, from what I've seen, just seems to be all over the place.
I couldn't disagree with any of that, to be honest, chaps. We should probably move on to the Champions League final of 1995. Ajax 1, AC Milan 0. Not that I didn't enjoy the game, but if I was to blame someone for picking this game, who would I blame?
It was me. Yeah, and it was also to try and protect Musa, because he wanted to watch Red Star. To one for the team. I brought you all down with me.
I mean, Kurt said, he sent a tweet going, I've just finished watching this game. Honestly, I thought it was worse than the final of last year. I didn't know the result, but it was before my time. This was the first time I watched it. And it was interesting, as we were watching the game, and we started, the adjectives about 20, 30 minutes in were sort of absorbing, tactical, intriguing.
Game of chess.
Barry said, shit. Game of chess.
KG.
I mean, it's a game of almost no chances. Barry, did you enjoy it?
I enjoyed watching it with you guys, but the game itself, not hugely. I think it's probably more to do with the backstory. The, you know, it's a bit of a fairy tale for Ajax, and they won the game with a skanky scuff goal late doors from a young Patrick Kluivert. It wasn't a particularly good game, but the story behind it is interesting, because Louis van Gaal, who, you know, became a bit of a joke figure in England during his time with Manchester United, I think a bit unfairly, or well, very unfairly, to be honest. But he built this team of young players. I think his squad of 18 in the Champions League, and 14 of them, I think, or 13 of them, came through the Ajax Academy. It would have basically been the equivalent of last year's Ajax not falling at that semi-final hurdle against Tottenham and going on to win the final. You know, this exciting young team of players none of us knew particularly well. But, you know, the team that beat AC Milan in this final, the talent in there, you've Van der Sar, Reisiger, Blind, Rijkaard, the two De Boers, Seedorf, Davids, Kanu, Litmanen, Kluivert, Finidi, George, Mark Overmars. I mean, what a team. But at the time, their average age, I think, was about 22. It's a good backstory. The game itself wasn't up to much.
I mean, that's what we were saying, Moose, isn't it? The really fascinating thing about this game is the collection of human beings, the collection of players who are on show on the pitch. You've mentioned the Ajax players there. You know, Milan have got Maldini and Costa Curta and Baresi and Albertini, Donadoni, Desai, Boban. It's an extraordinary set of players and careers that you are watching there.
Right. And the thing with Milan in this game was, despite having all, this was their third straight Champions League final. They'd lost to Marseille in 93, then won the year before against Barcelona, and now they faced Ajax. And their whole agenda was containment. If you look at that midfield, for example, the Milan midfield, there's almost no goals in it. Desai, Donadoni, Albertini, and Boban, like, none of those players are prolific, right? You have Massaro, who scored two goals in the previous final, but he's not a regular goal scorer. And again, Simone was the same. And it just felt like the context of it, if you look at Fabio Capello, he had looked at the last game Ajax had played in the Champions League, which was basically the 5-2 destruction of Bayern. And the mistake Bayern made was opening up against Ajax, and they got blown away. And clearly Capello was like, we're not going to give these people any room at all. We're going to compress everything, make them break us down. And so we were robbed of a great spectacle, but the fact we were robbed was a testament to the brilliance of Ajax, because even in that game with so few chances, even especially in wide areas, like Finidi George was quite dangerous in wide areas, when there was a mere chance of Ajax opening up, you saw just in flashes how dangerous they could be if they lost the concentration at Milan.
It's fascinating watching Van Gaal and Capello both looking young and simultaneously looking as old as they are now. marching around on the touchline. Did we see, Ryan, like a battle of two great tacticians there?
Honest answer is I don't really know. It seemed to be one of those games that you see quite often where there is the established favourites, where you have obviously Milan in this scenario. And I think we were commenting on it during the game that the difference in the how high the defensive lines were. And it seemed to be that most of the ball was kind of in the Milan half. And whenever Ajax had it in midfield, Milan were very, very, very deep. Kind of goes to what Musa was saying before, like Capello learning from that semi-final. Whereas Ajax had that energy of being the kind of fearless youngsters in a way who hadn't got to that point before and didn't really know how much there was to lose. I think that's a balance that I always find really intriguing in football. And it's something that the Ajax squad of last season started to encounter more that they progressed through the Champions League.
Talk about Ajax's youth, but I think we all agreed during the game that the standout player was Frank Rijkaard. And he was sort of playing as this deep lying midfielder, just spraying the ball around. And their whole plan was get it wide to Finidi George or Mark Overmars, cross it in, and it worked eventually. I mean, it's one of those games. It could have gone either way. There was only the kick of a ball in it, but it happened to go Ajax's way. And as I said, the goal wasn't one of the great Champions League final goals by any stretch of the imagination, but they all count.
Rijkaard assists Cliver, and it must have been a fascinating time for him, Musa, because, you know, he was at Milan for 5 years, from 88 to 93, came from Ajax, and now is back at Ajax.
Yeah, I always wonder what the tensions might have been in that dressing room in relation to that, because, you know, they have the three Dutchmen, Hullet, Van Basten, Rijkaard, the first great era of Milan in the mid-80s, and he was the kind of least heralded of the three, but actually had probably the most fulfilling career. Like, he ended everything on his terms. And so he scores the winning goal in the European Cup finals, it then was, against Benfica, I think at the same end, in the same stadium, making the same run that he made 5 years later when he makes the assist for Cliver. So actually, it's funny. In 1990, he scores this goal, goes right down the middle through the 18-yard box. And in 1995, he is making the same run that he made to score the winner. But the really cool thing is, it's like, I've got a young buck to do that for me, got a teenager to do that for me. It's cool. So there's a really nice kind of moment of, there was a moment in the first half when you had Seydorf, Davids, and Rijkaard all playing in the same line with actually almost exactly the same haircut. And it was so cool. It was like a proud uncle and his two nephews who finally done a better trick than him. And it was so incredible, like, watching that. So there was a lot of like big uncle energy in the Ajax team, I think, especially with Danny Blind as the sweeper, who actually, nothing to sweep, actually, as it turned out. But one thing I want to say before, I know I'm saying a bit, but one thing I want to say quickly as well is, arguably the second most important player in that final was not even playing or selected. It was Savicevic, because Savicevic was devastating the year before when they played on the break against Barcelona, and he was devastating in the semi. He assisted Boban for a late winner at PSG, and then they came back to the San Siro and he scored twice. And without him, Milan had absolutely no one to link midfield and attack. They had no one to play in a free role. So in a sense, it was like Muhammad Ali against Foreman, only they were on the ropes the whole time and there was no eighth round. There was no punchback.
Milan were toothless and Fabio Capello didn't really seem to have any answers or solutions to give them teeth. Whereas Louis van Gaal made some brave calls in the second half. He took off Clarence Seedorf, brought on Kanu, an 18-year-old Kanu, and it took off Jari Litmanen, one of my favourite players of all time, and brought on Patrick Kluivert, who I think was 18 at the time. He scored the winner. So they're big shouts to make in a Champions League final. But he had total trust in his team. He had brought them through from the youth system, as I said. He discarded some very good players. He famously got rid of Brian Roy because he thought Brian Roy is a very talented player, but his basic thing was, he's too thick to play for me. He's not clever enough to play in my system. So he flogged him off to Foggia, I think it was, in Italy. But that was how merciless he was. If you weren't, you needed intelligence as well as talent, because it was all about the team ethic.
Yeah, absolutely.
And part of the fun of watching these games and going back this far is just to see people that we grew up with and seeing players look so young. I mean, seeing Edgar Davids without glasses and looking, and Seedorf looking young is, you know, is sort of, there's a joy in seeing that for me.
Yeah, I think there's something about, because the first time we encounter these players in real time, if we're born when these matches were taking place, which we all were, we're not encountering them as legends. And then enough time has gone where they are so ingrained in our brain as legends. I find it, there's something kind of romantic in a way, without wanting to use such a loaded term, about going back and watching them before they were considered legends again. It's really strange. And we've, I mean, tonight we're recording this and it's the last two episodes of The Last Dance, the Michael Jordan documentary, are going up, and me and Musa have been talking about this a lot. And it's, for me, it's a really, that's a similar thing that's at play there, going back and seeing these people evolve into the legends that we now kind of only remember them as. We don't remember 18-year-old Kanu. We remember Seedorf as the uncle that Musa referred to, like Rijkaard being, really.
Right.
We remember him playing that role. We don't remember him being one of the kind of like the youngsters that was playing next to the player that he became. So that, for me, I find really, really interesting, and something that is easy to forget, because you develop such a close relationship with those players that you watch over years and years and years, and you remember them how they retire more so than when you first encounter them.
It's a similar thing with classic games. You remember them being all action start to finish, but no game is all action start to finish.
I will say, the only exception to that, the only game that was spectacular from the very beginning to the end to the final horn, was still Nigeria-Brazil. Because, I mean, the food, can I just say, shout out to Nigeria 4, Brazil 3, 96 Olympic semi-final, only because the music and the food alone around that game, the mixtapes, the chat. Imagine if you'd had WhatsApp then. The trash talk between a combined Nigeria-Brazil trash talk would be the greatest. But back to your point, Max, being seriously, back to your point about, we do remember games the way we want to. And what's funny with Milan, you know, sometimes you watch these teams and you think, you know, when you see certain games, you're like, this was a game too far. Or this was a final too far. I think PSG would have been a much better opposition with the team they had. With George Weah peaking, I think PSG, Ajax would have been a much better final. Like, PSG had many more weapons up front. They had much more variety in their attack. I just felt like Milan were almost like, they were there, but you know, like it's like a rock band doing one final tour, because you've got a second mortgage and you've got whatever, but actually it's like, well, should we really be here? And actually Milan, as it turned out, you know, we didn't know that at the time, but if someone said to you, do you know what, this is actually kind of the end of the party for a while. Milan won't be back here until 2003. If you'd said to someone, Milan would not return to the European Cup final for like 8 years, no one would have believed you at that point.
It's a bit like, this is, you know, this is the last dance for Milan, but they thought it might go on forever.
I love that you've said that, because I'm fascinated by teams that decline and why sometimes managers don't clock it. Now, Capello obviously was a bit smarter, because he actually goes off to Madrid in 1997. So he's already kind of aware this is the end of a cycle. But if you look at the age of the defenders, they've all come through together. You look at the fact they haven't really got that much attacking depth. Lentini was on the bench, I think, but didn't come off and didn't do anything. So, and I think he'd been in a car crash actually as well. I'm not sure what the circumstances were, but there was a lot around that team that Capello, who's a smart, he's a shrewd guy, he would have been like, we're probably done here. This is probably as much as I can get at. And arguably, actually, this Milan team overachieved, considering probably shouldn't have won the last European Cup, actually, on form.
What's interesting as well, because we had the Ajax team last season, which sort of broke up and their star players moved on. Whereas this one didn't really. Clarence Seedorf, I think, was the only player who left at the end of the season. And I mentioned earlier, I didn't know this off the top of my head, so I'm not going to pretend I'm super duper clever, but the December after this final was when the Bosman ruling came in, which, you know, obviously gave players freedom to leave at the end of the contract on free transfers. But whether or not that was relevant to subsequent shenanigans, I don't know. But this Ajax team actually kind of stayed together, but didn't go on to achieve any success of much note. I must say as well, I think a man who deserves a shout out, he was an unused substitute on the night of this final and continued in a fine tradition of being well rewarded for doing nothing. Hats off to Mr. Winston Bogart, who went on to have that stellar career at Chelsea, earning £40,000 or £50,000 a week for, I think, 4 appearances over 4 years. Was he somewhere else between? I have a vague recollection of, was he at Barcelona between Ajax and Chelsea? Or did
yes, he went to Barcelona with the whole Van Gaal revolution. But here's the funny thing with that. Bogard now, like what he did, no one bats an eyelid now. There are players who play almost no games at all for their teams. And there's not a fraction of that criticism. That makes sense. Like, you know, now it's complete. I mean, this was almost, I mean, he was unlucky because he was the beginning of this wave. But there are hundreds of footballers earning tens of thousands a week and no one bats an eyelid, and they're not playing for their teams.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me a bit of you know, Jack Rodwell in Sunderland Till I Die at Sunderland. But yeah, he was on £40,000 a week and he appeared 11 times during 4 years. Of his contract, he said, "Why should I throw €15 million away when it's already mine? At the moment I signed, it was in fact my money, my contract."
He started the final the year after against Juve, which I find funny because, yeah, like we say, we kind of assume that he's always just kind of not really around. But I always forget that they went to that second final. But I think that in terms of the long-term thing, I think they lost Seedorf and Rijkaard after that final in 95 because Rijkaard retired in one of the greatest retirements ever. I think, you know, going back to Ajax, winning a European Cup against his old side and then retiring. And Seedorf making one of Musa and I's favourite transfers ever, where he goes to Sampdoria for a year, even though he was supposed to go to Real and went to Sampdoria for a year and then went to Real, which is amazing. But yeah, like Barry said, like most of that side did stay together. Kluivert started on the bench the following season in the final as well, which I found a little bit funny. I assumed by then he would have made it to a starting position.
We should also mention Ipswich fans would like a shout for Fanidi George. And on the AC Milan bench was Stefano Iranio. As producer Jonathan said, the footballer who sounds most like Vic Reeves is rubbing his legs on Shooting Stars, who went in 97 from AC Milan to Derby County.
As you do.
Yeah, why not, eh? A bit of detail about this tournament. 94-95 Champions League had just 24 teams in it. Manchester United were the only English side in the tournament. They went out in the group stages. IFK Gothenburg won their group. Barcelona was second. Ajax and Milan were in the same group, and Ajax won both those games 2-0. Milan had 2 points docked after a game against Casino Salzburg. During that game, Salzburg keeper was hit on the head by a bottle and was taken to hospital. That put Milan level on 5 points with Salzburg. They qualified for the knockouts on goal difference. Top scorer in the competition, anybody want to guess?
George Weah.
Correct. 1 point for Musa on 7. Jari Litmanen, second on 6 goals. Simone of Milan and Magnus Erlinmark of IFK Gothenburg were level on 4. The Cup Winners' Cup. Does anybody remember the big moment from the Cup Winners' Cup final in this year?
It's got to be Naeem, is it?
Point for Barry. Naeem from the halfway line. Zaragoza beating Arsenal 2-1. God, that was such an extraordinary moment. Was it the last minute? Was it, Ryan, you're heading your hands here. Was it the last minute?
It was.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, thanks. Can we move on?
Did he actually dedicate it to Spurs fans everywhere?
I think he did as well.
Oh, yeah. My goodness. Oh, my goodness.
I still have nightmares about that game.
Troll level 1,000.
In the UEFA Cup, as soon as we finish this, I'm going to go on YouTube and watch that goal. UEFA Cup. That year, Parma beat Juve 2-1 over 2 legs. So there's your roundup if you wanted to know what happened in European football in 94-95. And that'll do for part two. In part three, we'll bring Archie Rintat on board and the five of us will chat about the return of the Bundesliga. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So the Bundesliga returned, the first of the major European leagues to do so. So pretty useful that Musa and Ryan are with us. And let's bring in Archie Rintat too to round it all off. Archie, how are you doing?
Very well, very tired, but good.
Now, yes, you're literally in bed as we record on a Sunday night, Archie, with your duvet over you. If you fall asleep at any time, that's totally fine.
I'm very comfortable, Max.
No, I'm pleased.
I'm not going to lie. It's
I'm
great.
Pleased. So, Archie, you are the only one of us who's actually been into a football stadium. What was it like?
It was really weird, Max. I don't usually have to have my temperature taken before going into a game and then be reminded on a few occasions that I really needed to wear my mask every single where that I went. That was in Frankfurt in particular. A very strange experience, especially interviewing players with a boom mic, so a long metal stick being stuck over from the stand in the direction. And at all times, even when I was walking with my cameraman, at one point somebody came up to us and said, 2 meters, make sure you're 2 meters. So yeah, I would say very rigorous implementation of the guidelines as far as I saw it. And I felt really quite safe, much more so in comparison to how I feel in everyday life right now in these circumstances, because yeah, the measures were very stringent.
So just talk us through the process then. When you get to the ground, what happens?
So first of all, I have to fill out a questionnaire which says that I've not been in contact with anybody who's had COVID-19. I then hand that over to somebody at this separate site where my temperature is then taken. I then get my accreditation and I drive round to my parking spot in the stadium after I've shown my accreditation. And then after that, I'm inside, but I'm only allowed into the stand part of the stadium. Like, if you're a player, obviously you're allowed on the pitch, but that kind of what they call like the inner room of the stadium, that's a direct translation, it makes it sound very exclusive, but yeah. And then from there, your contact is only with other members of the technical crew, because I was working for the Bundesliga World Feed at the weekend.
And what was it like watching elite level football with no fans there?
You felt it even more keenly in Frankfurt, because there is a team that were effectively pushed to a Europa League semi-final by their fans. And to be somewhere like that, where there is no one apart from 300, including the players, and yeah, you just hear things that you don't normally notice, like the cargo planes from Lufthansa flying overhead, the screams of anguish from the players. I noticed that Barry heard a couple of players shouting Schnell, Schnell. And yeah, it's just those little details, I guess, that you don't usually hear. So yeah, it was a bizarre experience in that sense, but it was just, it's a shame that it has to go ahead without the fans, because they really are the soul of the Bundesliga.
I don't follow the Bundesliga religiously, so I was thinking, I was watching the Dortmund game thinking, well, I know Dortmund a little bit, but these are not teams that I know every little bit about them. And there'll be no atmosphere. But actually, I found I really, really enjoyed it.
I felt like Dortmund came out hardcore. They were really intense. And I was shocked by how brutal the pace was in terms of how they forced the initiative. And I think it was a bit of a free hit for them in a funny way, Dortmund, because they kind of had Schalke where they wanted them on home turf, stripped of that kind of underdog. It was just like, our team is superior to yours. Our formation's great. We're going to go at you. So for the first 10 minutes, I didn't really get into the game. I was still kind of caught up in, should this be happening? But I think after a while, just like seeing how Dortmund had adapted to the loss of Emre Can, Axel Witsel, with Delaney and Dowd in the middle, it's so good. I kind of got into the game after, allowed myself to enjoy it a bit more.
So actually, you very quickly got into the action, the football, the players.
Yeah, yeah. After about 20 minutes, I really got into it, because it's just exciting to see how Dortmund, and they've got such a great squad of players. The Who Scored website published a list of the best under-21 players in the Bundesliga just before the game started. And I remember thinking, my goodness, like that under-21 side is arguably, with a couple of changes, the best team in the Bundesliga. And the overwhelming percentage of those under 21 players at Dortmund, like their young players, are so exciting. And so I guess from that perspective, I think once I sort of got onto that narrative, I was fine after that. I just watched it like a normal game of football, really, after that.
Yeah, I wanted to just pick up on something Archie said before, and I think it's something that is really important to stress here, is that the fans are the soul of the Bundesliga. It's one of the major factors that makes the Bundesliga such a special league, in my opinion. And I think that we maybe have to get out of our heads the judging it against that, because we're kind of operating in a different sport at the moment, I think. It's very much so. I wrote a piece last week for The Ringer about the Bundesliga's return, and I used a phrase in there that was very much like another industry returning under very strict conditions in order to secure its future survival. So we have to kind of put up with this at the moment in order to return to those days where we do get the full Bundesliga experience, which is massively reliant on the fan base. And there aren't many places that highlight that more in the Bundesliga, which is rich of very, very incredible atmospheres, than Frankfurt and Dortmund. I think I was actually watching the games in Germany on Sky. We have a thing called the Konferenz, which is almost like a red zone. So it cuts from game to game to game. And I chose that deliberately because I felt it might make the process of watching the game a little less alien, because you're cutting around anyway. So it was actually less noticeable because I was kind of doing stuff and had it on, and it was cutting when there were goals. And yeah, I mean, I think that it's great to hear the noises. I mean, we were commenting on it before football shut down. We caught a lot of the games that were being played behind closed doors anyway. In fact, the last game in the Bundesliga, I believe, was Gladbach Köln, which was also a ghost game, as they call it in Germany. And you could literally hear droplets of rainwater falling next to microphones, which you can never hear in Gladbach, as I'm sure Archie will tell you.
No, completely. I was at that Gladbach Köln game as well. That felt like a much sadder prospect than this, I would say, actually. And the funny thing is that I think being at home, you can hear certain things better than you can even in the stadium now. For example, because of where the microphones are stationed in the stadium, you can hear when the ball hits the net really quite cleanly, and you don't hear that when you're in the stadium. So that's one thing that you get at home. Worth mentioning the protests, or I would say probably the most colourful protest that we saw in the league this weekend, which was in Cologne, of course, where a couple of ultras put a sofa with Against Ghost Games in front of the stadium to try and make their point. The interesting figures for me were 60% of the TV share was on Sky during the conference that Ryan's talking about there. The conference has been going since 2000, I think it is now, in Germany. So it's a very popular concept. But you've also seen 60% of fans in Germany supposedly being against the Bundesliga's return. The one thing I would say about that second figure there is it doesn't really show how much each individual cares exactly. And I think that's what the TV figure shows, is that just if you turn on the TV, it doesn't show how you feel towards it. There'll be people who were turning onto that, for example, maybe just to have a look. But that's all that matters for the TV company, I guess. It's that, did you turn on your TV? You did. Okay. And that's what Sky, in this particular case in Germany, needed.
Moussen, what's your sort of feeling been about whether these games should be being played?
I'm in two minds, because while I understand that they're necessary for the continuation of the game and the survival, I have a slight concern that a lot of the conversations that should be happening about improving the experience of the match-going fan haven't been resolved. So things like cost, access, all the rest of it. And I just worry that in the euphoria to have football back on our screens in some form, those conversations will be swept by the wayside. And the reason I'm concerned in particular is because when Karl-Heinz Rummenigge came out and said there'll be, I think, billions of people watching, and it was just such a kind of like, it was like, wow, that's like a capitalist festival all of a sudden. I was like, hey, hang on, man. Like, there's a lot of things that were wrong with football before this break, and we need to use this period to navigate those issues. And I just worry that we haven't really navigated enough of them in the short time we've had away from football.
Can I just say, when was the last time Karl-Heinz Rummenigge came out with a take and you were like, yeah, man, yeah, good point.
Actually, earlier today.
Yeah, that is a good point, Archie.
Earlier today, he came out with a quote where I was like, you know what? He picked a fight with the German FA president, basically.
That's a free hit.
My thing is, because right now, like, Rummenigge is the de facto face or the voice of this project. And he's not the guy you want being the voice of it or the face of it. He's not the compassionate face. He's the hard, like, number crunch. And I'm not a fan of that. So from my perspective, I'd rather it was someone else doing the kind of being the leadoff hitter.
For the first time in a long time, we can actually talk about some football that actually happened. And Dortmund blew Schalke away. And Ryan, you were saying just before we came on air that you've got a feeling that this behind closed doors thing could really help Dortmund in their, you know, their aim to win the league.
I think, yeah, well, I want to caveat that by stressing how important Dortmund fans are and how great they are. I've said it a number of times before, the Westfalenstadion is one of my favourite places in the world to watch football, but I think that this is still ultimately quite a young Dortmund side, and in the same fixture last season, which I think Archie was at as well, I was there, they lost 4-2 at home to Schalke. A fixture, they famously blew the 4-0 lead a few years ago. They were ahead last season, ended up losing the game, which I think it was, my memory might be incorrect, but I think it was the following week they then surrendered a 2-goal lead in Bremen to Werder, which kind of really threw their Bundesliga title challenge off the rails. And I think that this is such a deeply talented Dortmund side, but if you look at it compared to the Bayern Munich squad, there aren't a huge amount of medals there or championships. Obviously, you have experience of people like Mats Hummels and various other players. Lukas Piszczek has been there a long, long time. Marco Reus, obviously. But the real talent are the youngsters. And I think that, weirdly, playing in quite a serene environment may benefit Dortmund, because it kind of feels like it could be a plus point for them to try and almost create an environment where the games feel as unimportant as possible. It may free them up to play better football, especially they're managing a lot of injuries as well, like a number of squads are. However, yeah, like I say, in my ideal scenario, everyone would be back, the fans would be there, football would be normal. But I think that if out of the top three or four, it's just a feeling, it's based on nothing, but I thought that maybe this might actually not be the worst thing for Dortmund for the run-in.
And how glorious was that fourth goal for Dortmund outside of the left foot from Guerrero? It's just an absolutely brilliant finish.
Well, yeah, Guerrero's had like a sort of second wind because they brought Nico Schulz in. But then Guerrero went to a different level. I mean, it's funny because he's 26. He's been around a while. But in terms of like, I've compared him in a sort of piece I've done that's coming out a bit soon on our site, actually, to Lizarazu, in the sense that Lizarazu just like locked down the left flank, very dependable defensively, but had a really good finishing touch. Didn't score necessarily that many goals. Actually, to be honest, actually, Guerrero scores a fair few, but it's just such a complete left-sided player. And the goal was beautiful because it's kind of like Dortmund at their best. It's weird because even though Dortmund's best players weren't all on the pitch against Schalke, that goal, I feel, was like Dortmund. That was kind of, if you're going to pick a moment from the weekend that was an advert for team football in the Bundesliga, I think that fourth goal is probably it.
What about Bayern, Archie? You got the impression that if they wanted to, they could have stepped it up a bit, but they didn't really have to try that hard.
That's not what Thomas Müller was saying after the game. He felt that they got drawn into playing the same way as Union wanted them to, i.e. broken up play, quite bitty, but I think they got the job done. And in that sense, it was very Bayern. Robert Lewandowski increasing his goal tally for the season as well. There's talk of whether he could hit the 40 mark, which is something of a magical figure over here, because Gerd Müller is the only person to have done that in Bundesliga history. And then the header from Benjamin Pavard, who a year ago, let's not forget, was relegated at this very stadium with Stuttgart as a World Cup winner. which is a very odd prospect to think about. So yeah, I think Bayern were okay, but as we have to remember with all these sides, physically right now, they're not quite up to it. I thought Union did very well given that coach Urs Fischer wasn't on the sidelines due to a bereavement in his family. But also with Union, the fans there, Ryan's made the point already, but Union is another one of these clubs where it's all about the atmosphere. It's all about the cauldron. And Thomas Müller was saying himself, actually, that there was probably an advantage for Bayern there with the fans not being around. So,
but which Bundesliga fans are rubbish? Because you've just, you know, everyone's like, well, easy, these Matt. Fans are the best one. There must be one who are rubbish.
Let's go for it.
Wow, this is brave. This is brave, Rachi.
It's not. You just, look, if you always pick on the commercial clubs, it's very easy. So
name names.
Hoffenheim is not a great atmosphere. RB Leipzig is not great either. Wolfsburg's okay. Their ultras actually have quite a nice sense of humour, I find, with some of their banners. But yeah, Hoffenheim and Leipzig, I would say, are the quietest.
It's gone for the low-hanging fruit, Archie.
Well, the low-hanging fruit is also the truth.
Leipzig were held at home. Was that a surprise? Because I'd heard that Freiburg had had much less time to train because of the way the health service is set up in Germany, that different clubs could start training earlier. So it must have been... Was that a big surprise, Musa?
It was. I mean... It's a bit spicy because the Freiburg ultras, again, Felix Tamsit put out a great summary of what they said beforehand, a translation on his Twitter page. They were referring to Leipzig as the marketing product from Leipzig. So that they hate, these are two teams that actually ideologically, they're poles apart in terms of their view on modern football. And so for them to get a draw off Leipzig was a real finger in the eye. And I think this is Leipzig's third straight draw. It's completely arrested their championship momentum and it's taken away their aura. They were at one point blowing teams away. In the midpoint of the season, they were taking teams for like, you know, 5-6 goals. They were killing teams.
I mean, they hammered Spurs, didn't they?
Well, yeah. But now they've hit a bit of a buttress, actually. This was a shock result and I think it's really bad for them, not only in terms of the league table, but also psychologically.
And... You know, Freiburg were unlucky with a VAR call. I mean, not unlucky, but it was very tight. And any other results of interest, Archie?
Just trying to think now. To be honest, I actually had a question for Baz.
Oh.
More than anything, which was, like, as somebody who watches a lot of Premier League, how did you find this in comparison? I know that physically the players weren't quite there, but just what was your overall impression of it?
In terms of the actual football played?
Yeah.
I watched all of the Borussia Dortmund Schalke game. I mean, I just found it weird. I haven't decided yet whether I enjoyed it or not. I watched a bit of the Borussia Mönchengladbach game. I watched the first half of that where they won. Was it against Eintracht Frankfurt? And I'm not sure I'd be in a huge rush to watch more. I will if it's on. I may well have to out of duty. But there were rows raging on Twitter about, you know, some people going out of their way to announce that they would not be watching. And some, you know, people were saying without fans, football is nothing. But... You know, most football games that are played without fans. You know, Max, you play in them all the time. I wouldn't imagine you're overburdened with supporters cheering you on or booing you in the touchline. Your game. And the guys playing it seemed to enjoy it. It was weird. It was all right. I was very impressed with Borussia Dortmund and very unimpressed with Schalke. But that's the thing. I didn't really know what to expect. And I don't know many of the backstories there. So there's no sense of jeopardy for me watching it. If I'm watching a Premier League match, generally there is one team I will want to win and one I will want to lose. And for whatever reason, if I'm watching Borussia Dortmund against Schalke, I don't care. I just don't care who wins or loses.
Producer Jonathan says biased journo.
I mean, I just wanted to say one thing, because obviously there are a lot of people who are watching the Bundesliga for the first time, having heard of all of the good things about it beforehand. And it's, I've said a million times, I think it will disappoint because you're not watching it at its full capacity. And in my opinion, it's, I mean, it is my favorite football league in the world, the Bundesliga. And whilst it was really quite lovely, I found on Saturday having everyone's attention focused on the same games, whereas usually they're quite scattered. You see people kind of tweeting about various games from various countries. I found it quite almost like unifying in a way that all the football Twitter were watching the same games. And I think that you will struggle to find a major league in Europe where the full effect of not having fans there will be greater than the Bundesliga.
The Premier League meet on Monday and they will vote on whether to allow players to return to training in small groups with social distancing measures in place. Meanwhile, League One and League Two had Zoom meetings on Friday. In League One, it's not that clear because 6 clubs had said prior to the meeting that they're determined to complete their remaining fixtures and now set to meet again on Monday in an attempt to find a resolution. So that's Peterborough, Oxford, Sunderland, Fleetwood, Portsmouth and Ipswich releasing a joint statement saying they had, quote, no desire for voiding the season, points per game scenarios or letting a computer decide our footballing fate. League Two voted to end the season. The EFL said clubs unanimously indicated they wish to end the season via a framework that included tables being decided on points per game and the playoffs remaining as planned. Any move still needs to be ratified by the EFL and the Football Association. Basically, it's just going to cost teams in League Two and a lot of teams in League One too much to do all the testing. And that's before you consider other costs such as bringing players out of furlough, transport, etc., etc., etc. So in League Two, that means Swindon overtake Crewe to claim the title using points per game. Plymouth stay in third. So the top three will all go up. The four teams currently in the playoffs, Exeter, Cheltenham, Colchester and Northampton, remain there as well. Cheltenham move above Exeter and into fourth. They voted for no relegation, which is interesting. So that is good news for Stevenage and Macclesfield because Stevenage were bottom. They were 3 points behind Macclesfield, had a game in hand. Macclesfield are facing a potential charge for failing to pay wages. They could have had points docked, but they will both survive if this is ratified. The National League were waiting to see what would happen with promotion. They decided to end all three divisions immediately on the 22nd of April. The most likely outcome is that the National League leaders Barrow will go up, obviously, because Bury went out of business before the season started. Barry, is that all clear?
Absolutely, yes. I'm not sure what I feel about this League Two thing. I totally understand that it will adversely affect clubs financially to have to finish the season with no gate money, but this thing of there being promotion but no relegation doesn't sit tremendously well with me, I have to say.
In Scotland, according to Sky, the Scottish Premiership 2019-20 season could end next week, with the SPFL expected to make a final decision which could see Celtic declared champions and Hearts relegated. All 12 Premiership clubs met via conference call on Friday. Chief Executive Neil Doncaster also invited into the meeting. More excitingly, Barry, you saw Scott Brown without a skinhead for the first time today.
Yes, he was being interviewed on Sky and he kind of looked like Homer Simpson when they're showing him when he's young and he's got hair. And he doesn't look half as tough or fierce at all as Scott Brown with hair. It was easily the strangest thing I've seen today.
And that's pretty much all we have time for today. Thanks so much for coming on. John says, has anyone ever told Musa just how brilliant his laugh is? It sounds like a supervillain after his big plan is revealed to everyone.
That is exactly... That's the intention. That's the intention.
It gets boring when you have to listen to it twice a week.
If you want to, Ryan, if you want to talk about getting bored with having to talk to the same person twice a week, I'm sure I can trump you.
Shall I ask Barry? What's it like, Barry?
Well, Ryan, imagine how often you'd have to listen to Moose's laugh if you were funny.
Oh my god.
Shots fired.
Oh my god.
This has become a roast, hasn't it? I didn't know. It is late.
Time out.
On that gloriously friendly note.
Barry came to war. Barry Bazooka.
Hey, Archie, thanks so much for your time.
It's okay. I'm just making my way through the popcorn now. All's good.
Musa, thank you.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Ryan, lovely to see you.
Thanks.
Barry, do you want to say anything nice to end the pod?
I've had a lovely time. Thank you, guys.
We will be back on Thursday. But before that, it is time for Chapter 9 of Detective Wilson. Chapter 9, The Fall of the Bear. 2:05 a.m., the morning of Sam's murder. Sam Diss's heart was racing as he made his way to Roots Hall. It had been one hell of a week for the Mundial kid. It had all kicked off when he received a handwritten letter. Dear Sam, in a couple of days I'll be sending you details of the biggest cover-up in football since Blatter and his cronies were escorted out of that hotel under the bedsheets. I'm afraid I cannot drop this off in person, as I fear for my life. I do not trust anyone else to get this out to the public. Please, Sam, do not hesitate. When I send you the information, you must publish it tout suite. Yours sincerely, a friend. Naturally, Sam thought it was a hoax. Mundial weren't one of the stuffy old guard of football news. They were the scrappy up-and-comers, the underdog. He guessed that whomever had sent the letter was just taking the piss. But 2 days later, the package arrived, and what was inside was monumental. Evidence of a top-to-bottom cover-up between FIFA officials and Amazon to all but destroy the lower leagues of English football. From there, they were going to Americanise the Premier League. No relegation, big teams playing each other over and over for maximum profit. Sam couldn't believe what had dropped in his lap. He was sitting on a gold mine. A couple of days later, though, he started to feel paranoid. He was pretty sure he was being followed. Hiring the Ramble Boys for protection had calmed his nerves somewhat, but he knew that he had to get the story out tout suite, as the letter had said. That was then he'd received another anonymous correspondence in his inbox. I know that you're in possession of something big. I have more evidence to back it up. Meet me pitch side at Roots Hall tonight. Come alone. If I see that you are not, you'll never lay eyes on what I have. Sam was nervous for sure, but if he was going to break the story, he needed to make it watertight. If this person had more evidence of corruption, it would only help him. The location, Roots Hall, sealed it in his mind. Clearly this was someone who cared about the lower leagues and wanted to help him, right? He was nervous for sure, but he hadn't come this far for no reason. In for a penny, in for a pound. The gates were unlocked when he got to the stadium, so Sam made his way towards the pitch, as instructed. Sam smiled. He loved the trip to this stadium. Many times over the years, he and his mates had headed down to catch a game, followed by a seafront jolly till late. He stepped out on the pitch and was reminded why he was going to so much trouble. Somehow fate had made him the first line of defence in protecting the lower leagues, and he wasn't going to back down now. He scanned the pitch for this deep throat, but he couldn't see anyone. Maybe he was early. Maybe he got cold feet. Maybe. Sam didn't have time to finish the thought as he was grabbed from behind. He fell backwards towards the floor and saw the face of his killer standing above him, a face only remarkable in how unremarkable it was. The darkness started closing in on Sam's vision. In his final moments, his mind went to that last game at Upton Park and Winston Reid rising high. He began to smile. The underdog coming through, rising to the challenge. That was what the game he loved was all about. That was what he'd tried to protect. He could almost hear the singing of bubbles in the air as he slipped into unconsciousness. 17 hours later. Wilson looked into the eyes of the killer as Max and Langdon lay on the floor between them. "Hello, Michael," he said calmly. Michael Cox, once of the same parish as he, stood smirking opposite him. "Hello, John. Been keeping well?" Still as pithy as ever, it seemed. Wilson looked at his old comrade in arms and wondered what path could have led Cox to this moment. "Why?" Wilson began to ask, but then there was an almighty shout from across the car park. "Cox!" The killer looked to Wilson and smiled. "I'm in trouble now." Glendenning marched over, breathing heavily and sweating profusely, the pain of the longest day of his career etched on his face. Cox looked at the two of them. "Well, here we are, back together again, like a Suarez, Sturridge and Sterling." "Good analogy, Michael," replied Wilson. "One exiled, one crocked, and the last one still firing. Just depends which one is which." "When I'm done with him, John, I promise you we all know which one of us is crocked," the bear growled. The former officer turned his gun on Barry. "Looks like I'm the only one still firing, Glendenning." Wilson needed to get his attention. "Bit sloppy for you, isn't it, Mike? Two bodies already, and now this." He gestured to Max and Langdon on the floor. Cox snarled. "Sometimes the game plan needs tweaking." He turned the gun on Wilson. "So is this it, then?" asked the ex-detective. "Take down me and Baz and disappear again?" The killer nodded nonchalantly. "Something like that." Wilson sighed. "If that's the way it has to be, you can at least tell us why." Cox looked back to Glendenning and shrugged. "You know me, boys. I go where the money is." All of a sudden, Rushton moaned on the floor and Cox was briefly distracted. Glendenning dived in two-footed to take him down. Wilson took his cue and tried to get the gun away. In the scuffle, Cox headbutted Wilson, making his eyes fill up with tears. Then he heard the gunshot. He hoped and prayed, but as his vision returned, he saw Barry lying on the floor, clutching his stomach. No, it couldn't be. Wilson felt the catamol rage well up inside him as he looked down at his old friend. He then heard the click of the pistol being readied once more by Cox. He looked up into the eyes of the cold-blooded killer that he used to call friend. You know, John, the killer said, I was always better. That is when the shot was fired. Wilson flinched, but nothing happened. When he looked back to Cox, he was holding his chest, blood running through his fingers. Behind him stood Special Agent Lars Sivertsen, his own smoky gun in hand. Cox dropped to the floor, and the memory stick fell into the puddle of DCI Glendenning's blood. Lars rushed over, shouting something, but Wilson couldn't make it out. All he could think of was the conversation he'd had with Flo earlier that day. Money in football has been dirty for a long time. This is just a natural extension of it. Next week, the final episode of Detective Wilson, Season 1, Till I Die.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.